Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Good evening.
And welcome to those who are here for the first time. And that would be
Tony
and
John.
Welcome. And welcome to those who are just getting here for the first time of this particular series. This is the fifth and last night of this Dharma Seminar series on this book, Mountains and Rivers Without End, by the great American Zen poet Gary Snyder. Some of you have been here all along, and some of you have caught some of these, and some of you, this might be your first night, and that's just fine. If you want to catch up, they are on the other talks are on the website, podcasts. And certainly there's much more in the book that we still haven't touched on. It's a series, a long series of poems that span 40 years of Gary Snyder's life. He started the project in 1957 and took to 90, and the book was published in 97, so 4 decades of his life. And it kind of takes the form of, or he frames it as like a Chinese landscape scroll. And so the poems touch on many of the important landscapes of his life and his Zen practice and his practice in the wild of the mountains and the rivers. And sort of weaving through the poems is this resonance with Dogen's, a text by Dogen, who was the Japanese founder of our particular stream of Zen, brought it from China to Japan, a text by Dogen called Mountains and Waters Sutra. So I won't give a whole lot more background because some of you have already heard a lot of it already, so don't worry if it's a little new to you. Just enjoy what you can of this this text. Dogen, in his Mountains and Waters Sutra, says, I'm going to read you the quote, but I want you to know just before I start to read that where the translation says wise men, I'm going to say wise people. Because the Chinese character is actually non-gendered, so it should be people rather than wise men. So Dogen says, from the distant past to the distant present, mountains have been the dwelling place of the great sages. Wise people and sages have all made the mountains their own chambers, their own body and mind. And through these wise people and sages, the mountains have appeared. These mountain sages have made the mountains their own chambers, their own body and mind. Maybe those of you who've done a certain amount of hiking in the mountains have some sense of that. Gary Snyder, who wrote these poems, must certainly rank among our modern-day mountain sages who have thoroughly entered the mountains, body and mind. So over the past few weeks, we've journeyed along with him through the landscape scroll of his life, which extends so far beyond his personal life. And his personal life threads through this, but beyond that, and include in the many details of from his personal life in this landscape, but he travels on trails through the mountains of Japan, Nepal, the North American West, and the deserts of the Great American Basin, the American Great Basin. If we'd taken a little bit more time, we could have sailed with him on freighters in the Pacific Ocean and the Red Sea, and kayaked, rafted, and canoed down the great rivers of North America. We would even have hitchhiked down long American highways with him and walked the sidewalks of city canyons and marketplaces. Throughout the book, this refrain which echoes Dogen comes, walking on walking, underfoot earth turns, streams and mountains never stay the same. That appears again and again. But for now, I think I will close this series with the very last poem of the book. And that's what I've just passed out. It's called Finding the Space in the Heart. So I'm just going to read through it, and I'm going to pause and comment as we go. Okay. I first saw it in the 60s, driving a Volkswagen camper with a fierce gay poet and a lovely but dangerous girl with a husky voice. We came down from Canada on the dry east side of the ranges, Grand Coulee, Blue Mountains, Lava Flow Caves, the Alford Desert, Pronghorn Ranges, and the glittering obsidian-paved dirt track toward Baia. Seldom-seen roads, late September, and thick frost at dawn. Then, following a canyon and suddenly open to silvery flats that curved over the edge. Oh, ah, the awareness of emptiness brings forth a heart of compassion. So that last line there, the awareness of emptiness brings forth a heart of compassion, echoes the line from Milarepa that the great Tibetan poet and mystic Milarepa, with which he starts the whole book. The notion of emptiness engenders compassion. Emptiness is usually associated with wisdom, the wisdom to see the true nature of being, which is impermanent and empty of separate self. When we say empty, it doesn't mean a kind of nihilistic voidness. It means that there is no separate existence, right? That we and everything else only exist in a kind of matrix of interconnection. So that's wisdom, is seeing that. And what this saying says is that what that opens into compassion, because we can, if we feel our connection to and our interdependence with all things, we our hearts naturally open to compassion. So wisdom and compassion, many of you have heard this, but are considered the two wings of our practice, wisdom and compassion, and if we don't have them both in balance, we can't fly. So in this last poem, Snyder's, as I said, he's kind of recapitulating this four-decade span of his life scroll. So this first section that I just read is from the 60s, right? You know, he's traveling with the gay poet and the scary woman.
Ginsburg.
In a book, yeah, it's Ginsburg. Probably Ginsburg. And it's got to be Ginsburg. And in a Volkswagen van, right? Those were, you know, the wild years of poets, women, and travel, and Zen and exploration for Snyder. So continuing on that same trip south from Canada, this is still in the 60s, we followed the rim of the playa to a bar where the roads end and over a pass into Pyramid Lake from the Smoke Creek side by the ranches of wizards who followed the teepee path. The next day we reached San Francisco in a time when it seemed the world might head a new way. I don't think the inhabitants of the San Francisco counterculture then could possibly have imagined the world as it is today. A half century later, I was still in high school, but I don't think I could have imagined what it's like now. Could you, Tim?
It's very different.
Yeah. Although we knew, you know, we knew that the clouds were gathering, that's for sure.
Well, that's true, yeah.
So moving on into the 70s, he says, and again in the 70s, back from Montana, I recklessly pulled off the highway, took a dirt track onto the flats, got stuck, scared the kids, slept the night, and the next day we sucked free and went on. So he's traveling the same road, and now he's got kids. So the 70s were his householding years. The years that he put down roots in one place for the most part. And here he gets stuck in the mud and scares the kids. You notice how particular he is about place names. The events in these poems happen in specific geographical locations, although some of his poems are situated in dream locations. And sometimes the real-time locations have dream time or myth time overlays. I'm going to read you a quote from David Abram, who's a kind of cultural ecologist and philosopher. He wrote an essay on Snyder's work in this book, part of a symposium on, they had a whole symposium on this Snyder's Mountains and Rivers Without End. And he sees the way Snyder writes in this way as a kind of renewal of oral culture. He describes how in traditional oral cultures, without written language, places are permeated with culture, right? This is where that happened. This is where that happened. This is where my grandfather killed a mountain goat. This is what Abram says. As you walk through the land, then, the places you meet and the sights you encounter are continually sparking the memory of the particular stories associated with those places and sites. The land, in other words, is the primary mnemonic, or memory trigger, for remembering the oral stories. So while ancestral knowledge is held, as it were, in the stories are held in the land. The landscape is alive with stories. So most of us, it's probably fair to say, came to this continent. There may be someone here who has older First Nations roots here as well, but most of us came to this continent either recently or several generations back, leaving those stories, those place-based stories, way far behind us. Right. So when we walk up in the mountains, there are no stories attached, so we start creating them, like Snyder is, right? This is where I got stuck in the mud. So Snyder's poems are alive with these stories, but not only from his own life, but the stories of humanity and our animal relations and the mythic realms that he includes. He's kind of weaving together this landscape of stories. Abram, whom I just quoted, quotes an interview an anthropologist did with an Apache man who had gone off to live in the city and returned a year and a half later. And this is what the man said, having lived in the city. It was bad. I forget about this country here. I forget all the names and stories. I don't hear them in my mind anymore. I forget how to live right, forget how to be strong. So I wonder how much we've all forgotten, living so disconnected from the plant and animal and elemental realms of the earth. Abram says, we no longer need the land to think with. Now the books carry the stories, and the land can begin to seem rather superfluous, unnecessary. Gradually the living land begins to recede into the background, flattening into a kind of backdrop for our more pressing human concerns. So landscape becomes something different, it becomes backdrop, instead of something we are living in and of. So the poem goes on into the next decade. 15 years passed. In the '80s, with my lover, I went where the roads end, walked the hills for a day, looked out where it all drops away, discovered a path of carved stone inscriptions tucked into the sagebrush. Stomp out greed. The best things in life are not things. Words placed by an old desert sage. Can't help but wonder if he knows who it was. Faint shorelines seen high on these slopes. Long gone Lake Lahontan. Cutthroat trout spirit in silt. Colombian mammoth bones 400 feet up on the wave-etched beach ledge. Curly-horned desert sheep. Outlines pecked into the rock. For those who were here last week, that Lake Lahontan was the ancient inland lake that's now the Great Basin of in the southwest part of the United States, Nevada and California. It was a huge big lake. Continuing, and turned the truck onto the playa, heading for No Knot, bone-gray dust boiling and billowing, mile after mile, trackless and featureless, let the car coast to a halt on the crazed, cracked, flat, hard face where winter snow spirals and summer sun bakes like a kiln, off nowhere to be or not be, all equal, far reaches, no bounds. Sound swallowed away, no waters, no mountains, no bush, no grass, and because no grass, no shade, but your shadow. No flatness, because no not flatness, no loss, no gain, so nothing in the way. The ground is the sky is the ground, no place between, just wind-whipped breeze, tent mouth leeward, time being here. We meet heart to heart, leg hard twined to leg, with a kiss that goes to the bone. Dawn sun comes straight in the eye, the tooth of a far peak called King Lear. So I had to Google King Lear Mountain, and it turns out it's in Nevada to the south of this spot where Snyder is looking, feeling this boundlessness of being. And he's echoing the Heart Sutra, which I'm sure many of you caught, when he says, no waters, no mountains, no bush, no grass, and because no grass, no shade but your shadow, no flatness because no not flatness, no loss, no gain, so nothing in the way. In the Heart Sutra, it's without any hindrance, right? Without any hindrance, there is no fear. Nothing in the way. And in the heart, as in the Heart Sutra, it says, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. And again, that doesn't mean that our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body don't exist, but that they only exist in relationship to each other and to the world around us. No waters, no mountains means no waters without mountains, no light without shadow, no gain without loss. How could there be any gain without loss? Impossible, right? So then he moves into the years of his maturity. Now in the 90s desert night, my lover's my wife. Old friends, old trucks drawn around, great arcs of kids on bikes out there in the darkness. No lights, just planet Venus glinting by the calyx crescent moon and tasting grasshoppers roasted in a pan. They all somehow swarm down here, sons and daughters in the circle, eating grasshoppers, grimacing, singing sutras for the insects in the wilderness. The wideness, the foolish, loving spaces full of heart. So in that section, he's now in his 60s. This is the amplitude, the great gratitude and generosity of coming back to a beloved place once again, this time with the next generation, a community of friends. You have the sense that this tough old mountain poet has mellowed some by now. He would have been 66 when he finished the poem in 1996. So that's already 20 years ago, right? So he's well into his 80s now. And 10 years after he would have written this poem, his beloved third wife, Carol Coda, who was 17 years his junior, would die of cancer at the age of 58. And he would keep on walking. Walking on walking, underfoot earth turns. Streams and mountains never stay the same. There's that refrain. It's like a chant for walking. Our Sangha member, Kaspar, many of you know, is going to set off very soon and run around the world. And we're going to give him a little ceremony this Sunday as a send-off. And he's made little patches, little stick-on patches, and he put this line, walking on walking under foot earth turns, on his little patch. It's really lovely. So if any of you are here on Sunday, you'll get to help with his send-off.
I think he's also going to bring his cart that he pulls as he runs.
Yeah, he has a little trailer that he will have, you know, a little harness around his waist and pull this little trailer. So, and he will meet the world as he goes, day by day. Dogen says, this is from the Mountains and Waters Sutra, although we say that mountains belong to the country, actually, they belong to those who love them. When the mountains love their owners, the wise and virtuous inevitably enter the mountains. And when sages and wise people live in the mountains, because the mountains belong to them, trees and rocks flourish and abound, and the birds and beasts take on a supernatural excellence. This is because the sages and wise people have covered them with their virtue. We should realize that the mountains actually take delight in wise people, actually take delight in sages. So surely the mountains took delight in this old poet sage, Gary Snyder. You may think this kind of talk is nothing but anthropomorphism, but think about ecosystems. Think about how they do thrive or not thrive, depending on our relationship to them. Again, David Abram, who I mentioned before, might help us see the basis of a kind of ecological ethics in our direct embodied experience of the mountains and waters and the beings that inhabit them. He says, the world of oral culture is a sensuous world because the sensuous world is always local. It is not what is happening on the other side of the planet, but right here, and it is never strictly human, since it is made up of the ground on which we walk and the gravity that holds us to that ground and the air that we breathe. this air that is breathed out by all the green and rooted folks around. The sensuous world is the face-to-face world that we inhabit with our sensing animal bodies, the world in which we are corporeally immersed and in which we bodily participate simply by the very fact of being here. And then he goes on, now it seems to me that ethics is not primarily a set of mental injunctions, but it is something we only really learn first with our breathing bodies, as our bodies come up against other bodies, against other beings, turtles and lichen-encrusted rocks and spiders delicately weaving their webs across our path, and robins wrenching worms out of the ground, and people, lots of people, and cottonwood trees and rivers swelling and drying up with the seasons. Ethics is what we begin to practice as we encounter these others in the flesh, face to face, and learn to orient and to dwell in the same world that they inhabit, learning to move with restraint and playfulness and an appropriate boldness. It is only in the thick of the palpable sensuous world that we really learn how to be with others and how to move with others. So consider that. Consider that. For Gary Snyder, poetics and Zen practice and ethics have always been intimately connected. The ethics part comes out more in his prose. But it's there, between the lines, totally there in the poetry. How we meet other lives directly through our embodied experience changes how we interact with and care for those other lives and for the vast watershed of this living earth. That's his other very strong sort of vision or metaphor throughout this book, is the whole earth as one big watershed. Of course, the water cycle, right, encompasses the whole earth. And this ethical concern, as I've said, has always been part of Snyder's practice and Dharma message. Abram suggests that, these are his words, what Gary Snyder is secretly up to is he's showing us how we may begin to find again the songs and stories hidden in the land. We should not fail to notice what these poems inadvertently tell us about not writing, about what we don't write down, about what exceeds and cannot be held on the written page. So notice how he ends the very last bit of the poem. It's kind of haiku-like verse. The space goes on, but the wet black brush tip, drawn to a point, lifts away. So the painter's brush lifts off the scroll. Have you ever watched a master calligrapher when Kaz Ta-Nehisi has come up here, when the way the brush lifts off the paper and the motion continues. It's really beautiful to watch. And over again in these poems, we've seen a boat floats off the page, or a raven flies off the page. Or in one poem we didn't read that's called Walking the New York Bedrock Alive in the Sea of Information. That's the title. There's a peregrine falcon that's living on a high ridge on the 35th floor. And the falcon sails past the window off the edge of the word chain. So again, there's these images of continuing on and off. The words take us to the limit, and then it's just this, our experience in this moment. Snyder's most recent book of poetry is called This Present Moment. came out 3 years ago. And it closes with the most devastatingly personal poem he's ever written about the death of his wife, followed by a single black page with white print saying, "This present moment that lives on to become long ago." So I hope you've enjoyed this journey through, along with Gary Snyder, through these landscapes over the past 5 weeks. I hope maybe it'll inspire you to see your own life's journey with a Dharma poet's eye, to look for the stories in the stones, and in the vivid, living, present moment. So, thank you for listening and traveling along with me, indulging me in my my favorite thing to do. One of my favorite things to do. And we'll stop.